right, hopefully that'll do it. All right. Hello, Michael. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Good. I appreciate joining here. I know we were supposed to start like half an hour ago, but we had some really good conversations right before we got started. I did want to kind of ask you about your history of how did you get into design, and maybe if you can give me an overview of, I know since the last time we spoke in person, you've moved to a new company, so I want to kind of hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Man, where to start? So I got into design actually while I was still in university. And so, I mean, you know, I was in SFU with you initially, and then I wound up throughout my time in CompSci, I was doing design courses on the side, and I was considering like whether to do a minor or a joint major or what. And after I got an opportunity to do a co-op in the government of Canada doing communications work, it sort of opened my eyes to this idea that, oh, there's actually quite a lot of opportunity for careers in design specifically. And since that's the part that I enjoyed a lot more, I wound up swapping over to that halfway through my third year or so, and finished off my degree in that. And then I got into the professional world. I continued working in the government of Canada for a little while after I graduated. I was part of a small startup at the time called Solid Ground Software, which may or may not seem familiar. And it's for your listeners who don't know, you and I co-founded that company together
years ago. You and I have known each other for decades. So yeah, a lot of common history there, including SFU.
Yeah, I guess to lay it out there, we've been friends since I was in the fifth grade. I think you were in the sixth grade. So correct. All the way since elementary school, through high school, through university, and right through now. So all that to say, you know, I was kind of doing design work alongside of communications work, moonlighting at this mobile app development company. And then when we closed the doors on that, I decided to jump over and do design full time. I wound up getting a job at a company called Lendesk, which makes software for, it's a B2B software connecting mortgage brokers and mortgage lenders in Canada. I don't know if you have international clients or international listeners, but will be very different depending on which country you go into. And in Canada, you would typically go and speak to a mortgage broker in order to get your mortgage, and they will help you put together your application and then submit that over to lenders. And that process is what Lendesk does as a software, among a few other things since its inception. But that's like that's a whole other podcast. And then just probably about 6 months ago or so, I left Lendesk after 6.5 years there and joined Routific, which is a company that makes logistics software specifically for last mile delivery operations. So not like long haul trucking, like you're, you know, driving your cargo from like Toronto to Vancouver, but that like last bit inside of the city limits of Vancouver where you need to make like, you know, 40 different stops. What's the most optimal route that you can take to make your deliveries, to save gas, to save time, and to be as efficient about it as you can?
Pretty cool. I was going to ask you about the Routific. That's a pretty big, I guess, change in industries compared to when you were at Lendesk. As a designer, how did you find that change? Is it difficult to jump into something completely different and having to understand the whole entire business industry before you can, I guess, have meaningful input into the design? How does that work?
To be honest with you, I just found it exciting. After working in mortgages for like 6.5 years, I was ready to tackle something else for a while. Like I wound up learning way more about mortgages than I ever wanted to know or that I ever thought I would want to know. And going through my own mortgage process a couple of times while I was there. You know, that was its own sort of experience. And then coming into a new industry, it's just really exciting, these other facets of the organization, things that, like, you know, I never would have necessarily thought about around the problem space that we're dealing with. And there's definitely like a significant ramp up time. It probably took, you know, a good couple of months before I was really comfortable starting to contribute in to a lot of these specific conversations. And even then, there was a lot of caveats like, well, you know, based on what I understand from, you know, this stuff from the user research pool or whatever, I think we should kind of go in this direction. So it definitely takes a little while, but it's really worth it, right? Like when you're learning something new, you're always a lot more engaged with it as you're starting to like peel back the layers and having all these questions for the people that you're with. And like, it's a fantastic company because everybody really put up with all of the many questions that I had to ask.
Is there, I guess, what's the design component in the last mile logistics that you're involved with? I mean, in my mind, when I'm thinking of last mile logistics, I'm thinking of probably like some complex algorithms for routing. Because from my understanding, that tends to be the most expensive part of delivery anyways, like the last mile, try to figure out what's the most efficient route. So what does design come into this whole process? And I guess maybe you can elaborate a little on that.
Sure. So there's a lot of touch points in there. So you know, when we're talking about the algorithm, like the algorithm is like the driving engine behind the software. But in order for a user to interact with it, there's got to be something there. And that is to say, like, they need to be able to input the various stops that they need to make along, just in totality. They need to upload, you know, some. They need to be able to identify some key pieces of information, like the number of vehicles that they have that are, you know, operational at any given time, the number of drivers that are working at times, along with the stops. There's things like, when do those deliveries need to happen? Like maybe some businesses need their deliveries done after hours. You know, maybe you're like part of a local brewery and you're delivering beer across, the lower mainland. Some places need you to show up before they're open. Some places maybe need you to show up after they're closed. Some places maybe they don't care. Maybe it's fine for you to make a delivery in the middle of the day or whatever else. You have to take all of these factors into account, traffic patterns, maybe other things, like, are you okay with your drivers maybe working overtime? Like, you need to make all these deliveries in the day and you don't quite have enough drivers. What do you do then? Are you okay maybe outsourcing to another company or to a courier or something like that? There's all of these things that you need to take into account, and they're all values that get plugged into this larger algorithm, but the user's not going to like do this complex formula and like figure out the math or like plug all this information in a spreadsheet. So the UI of that needs to be done. And then the outputs also need to be handled. So once we've created routes, users typically want to go in and inspect those routes because they may have an intuitive understanding around, oh, this might be better, this might be worse. And even though we've presented them with what is mathematically the most efficient formula, they may want to tweak them around a little bit and move things around. So there's a whole aspect to that. And then dispatching that information to your drivers and having the drivers, you know, we've got a mobile app that the drivers can use to see their routes, to navigate, to see their deliveries, but also to do things like list if they needed to miss a stop for some reason, like, oh, so-and-so wasn't home. I tried to make the delivery, didn't work. Or they did make a delivery, maybe they need to take a photo of something and upload that as part of the record for the stop. All that kind of stuff, as well as then tracking the drivers on the dispatcher side and seeing like, oh, you know, this Larry over here has progressed through this much of his route, whereas, you know, Jane is still kind of lagging behind over here for some reason. What's going on? And then maybe you need to intervene. There's a whole, there's a lot of components there that people will be interacting with, both the planning side and also like the actual management of like the artifacts that are getting output in terms of these routes.
Got it. What's your approach in designing software that your, you know, customers are going to love? Because it seems like you have a few customers that you mentioned in that scenario, or a few users, depending how you want to call them. How do you approach coming up with a holistic solution that addresses their needs, but also addresses, I think you probably have some internal customer needs that you need to balance out as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the $1 million question, isn't it? Like, if we could figure out how do you make software that people are going to love, like everybody's going to be a millionaire. I think I'll be honest with you, I actually think that it needs to start with a opinionated product vision. And you need to know, like, what is the software? Who is it for? And what is the purpose of it? So, you know, when it comes to like the logistics software industry, it's actually a pretty wide spectrum. And Routific focuses on like the fulfillment aspect of it, which is a really clean and niche way to look at it. And, you know, in the future, I don't know, maybe we'll expand to other aspects of it. For example, you could handle the order management side of things. And there's a whole other layer of work required around, like, well, what happens when somebody calls in an order? Well, what happens if somebody needs to perform a pickup or whatever else? That's something that we've decided purposefully not to be a part of, because it's a big problem space that we're not ready to deal with at this stage. And so focusing in on like this specific thing is really critical, because then it allows us to be really opinionated about what our software does and who it's targeting. So we've done a lot of research into the ideal user, right? Like the ideal customer profile, the ICP is the acronym that we keep throwing around in our company. And that is who we keep in mind when we're making all of these decisions. And that's the other thing, is like, when you're making decisions, you always have to keep that in mind. Whatever the feedback that's come in from the clients is, whatever bits of information you've gathered through interviews with prospective clients or through sales calls, like the sales, our sales folks and our customer success people are just invaluable tools to the design team, because they're just these fonts of information, because they're constantly talking to people. And they have a great intuitive sense of what people want, but they also have a pretty fantastic analytical mindset to say, like, oh, sometimes they have to dig in and ask, like, what is it the client is really asking for here? Like, we've gotten feedback, for example, in our, we have a new version of our product going into beta pretty soon. And some of the early feedback we've kind of received from people is that, oh, it's not colorful enough. And when I'm as a designer, like, that doesn't mean anything to me. I'm like, what do you mean it's not colorful enough? I'm like, you know, from my perspective, like, there's color needs to be used with a purpose, right? I'm not an artist. I'm use color for expression or to make people feel stuff. I'm there to use color as a tool to direct their attention to something or to move them through a particular screen or a page, and kind of like use that as an intuitive way to allow them to know, like, hey, this is the next step that you should take. And so I dug into that with the sales team. I was like, okay, well, what do you mean it's not colorful enough? Like, what's the problem with the lack of color? And after a bit of conversation, it came out that, like, oh, the color is not that it's a lack of color. The color is a little too samey. And so it makes it difficult to see individual sections of the screen that you're looking at. And so it's difficult to parse the information in what order should you go through these different parts, because there's, you know, multiple panels and stuff like that are open in our UI at any given time. So that's like that other thing, is like, listen to your clients, but then sometimes don't listen to them. And sometimes, like, dig into the information and see, like, what is at the core of their complaint? You know, what are they really trying to get at? What are they really asking for? Those are the sort of critical things. And then using that data and just constantly, like, referencing back to it to say, look, this is what people are saying. This is what people are asking for. And the earlier you can get your product in front of people, using it end to end on a day-to-day basis, the more meaningful that information is going to be, because, you know, we've done some testing on an alpha product, and it's been extremely useful. But until people are really digging in and using it, the feedback that they have, it's good, but it's probably incomplete, right? Like, until you've really dug into it, you know, you may say that this is a blocker for you, and it may be. And the inference from a statement like, oh, hey, I can't use this product without this feature, the inference is, if I build this feature, I can then unblock this user from using our product. And that's not true. there's probably other blockers that exist afterwards. And until like you can get somebody actually like flowing through end to end in your application or app or product, whatever it is that you've done, they're not necessarily going to be able to give you as valuable of a feedback as you can. So I know that was a lot of random things to cover, but I guess clear product vision, listen to your clients, use that data, judiciously, dig in to find out what's at the core of, your client problems, and also get meaningful feedback from them, usually through actively using the app that you've developed.
You mentioned something that I haven't heard before. You said opinionated product vision. What does that mean?
It means that your product can't be all things to all people. And that's how you get in trouble, right? When you try to appease everybody, you wind up appeasing nobody. So you have to make a decision. Like, for example, at Routific, you got to ask the question, like, okay, who is this product for? Is it for Amazon? Probably not, because Amazon, A, has their own software. But also, it's such a large, complicated corporation that maybe this isn't the problem that we necessarily want to tackle right now. Whereas we got to ask the question, do we want to target like mom and pop shops? Maybe somebody who does deliveries only once around Valentine's Day. You could make the user experience like really focused on this, highly technically non-savvy client. Like, I don't know what the opposite of tech savvy is. But this like, basically like making like your grandma, your target client base. And you could make software that is really easy to use in that sense and make a lot of decisions around it. But it's very different from the type of software that like a dispatcher at Amazon would use. Because once you're a dispatcher at Amazon, that's your full-time job. Like, you're not worried about, clean UI. You want as much information on the screen as possible. This is an issue we ran into when I was working at Lendesk, where we essentially create the same software to use for both the broker and the lender side of the equation. And it was somewhat successful. The problem was that like your average mortgage broker is, I think, if I remember correctly, it was like a 55-year-old woman. And they have very different needs from your average underwriter, who's like a 30-year-old male. When we were dealing with underwriters, they just wanted more information on the screen at the same time. Like, if we could have shoved everything onto one screen at like 8-point font, they would have been happy. Even though in theory, they're using the same information, but the mortgage brokers wouldn't have been able to read that at all. And so you got to ask yourself the question, like, well, who's this software for? Is it for mortgage brokers? Is it for lenders? And I think that's, an issue where we ran into some trouble early on in Lendesk, is not being opinionated enough, even because in theory, the same group of people could use the same software, but in practice, they have very different needs. And so that's what you have to do, is you have to find who your software is for. And that will allow you to create your opinions around how complex this should be. How much information do you need to display at the same time? Do you need like wizards to guide people through specific processes? Or can you just have a whole bunch of options open because this is a person's full-time job, right? Like, a great example is like Robinhood versus, a really complex day trading app where you have like all these graphs on your screen at the same time. Your day-to-day, like, your typical average Joe investor is going to be way too overwhelmed with all of this information. And so they need something simpler. They need like a wealth simple trade or something like that. Whereas your high-end stockbroker is not going to, like, they're not going to be satisfied with just seeing the basic stock price and maybe a stock ticker and a couple of values on their cell phone. Like, they need more information. So you got to know, who are you making this for?
That's a really good call. That's one thing I've been kind of fighting for in my industry, not at the current company I'm at, but at previous jobs I've had, where the thing I struggle with and to convey to leaders sometimes is that if you don't have this vision defined, you're making your developer's life harder. Because as a developer, even though it might seem like, okay, the developers are just pumping out code, but the reality is every day they need to make a decision, right? Do I do A versus B? Do I dig a little deeper here? Do I write code in a certain way that can be refactored, or do I kind of, is this something that's small piece? And if you don't have that vision, you're just leaving it up to chance for the developer to make the right calls whenever they kind of approach that fork in the road. Whereas with a well-defined vision, you can always come back to it and say, okay, our vision is, for example, in your case, or some of the examples you gave is like a grandma that's doing something. So if I'm going to build this, that's our product vision. Therefore, I'm going to make it in a way where it's easier, more user-friendly, even if it's not to do with the UI, right? If it's to do with just some of the functional things, how they're working on the back end. And it's interesting to see that in design that same thing applies, right?
Well, the designer is the same thing as a developer, right? Like, you're making decisions all the time. And you got to know, like, at the end of the day, what makes one decision better than the other? There's trade-offs and there's benefits to everything. And so you have to know, which direction do we want to move in? I mean, we've had this conversation, not you and I, sorry. I've had this conversation many times at every company that I've worked at. It's like, well, who is this for? Like, who am I targeting with this? Whether it's on the product design side of it or in like communications design, building like a marketing piece, like who is this piece of marketing collateral supposed to target, right? Like, who is this Facebook ad for? Who is this LinkedIn ad for? You know, we're putting out a, editorial in whatever publication. Who is it targeting? Like, who is the audience that'll dictate the type of language that you use, you know, that dictates the design patterns that you want to use, that dictates the size of the font that you want to use, to be like perfectly honest, because, you know, you and I are fairly young and we're used to working in like design and development environments. You know, I have my screen resolution cranked up even like on my 15-inch MacBook here, because I can read the small font. It's not that big of a deal for me, and I just want to be able to have more screen real estate.
So speak for yourself. I got my glasses here that I need when I'm looking at the at this screen. So I'm getting old, man.
I'm just stereotyping you into every developer I know that's got their, like, you know, 27-inch screen turned sideways and is trying to read like every line of code in their 1,000 code or their 1,000-line library.
I think that's a very good point, though, about even something as simple as a font could make a big difference in how the user perceives it.
Yeah. And like different choices of fonts will also impact it as well, right? Like, Roboto is like a nice little clean font that Google loves to use. And I think it's their default material design font now. And it's good, right? Like, you can use it in smaller spaces. You can make it smaller and you can use it in tighter spaces, sorry. So with less padding and stuff like that around it. You can't necessarily get away with that in like a serif font with all these like little fancy, you know, tabs along the bottom of it or along the bottom of each letter. You need a bit more breathing space to make that legible. And you have to take all of that kind of information into account, along with all of that sort of factors into your decision making around like your brand identity, for example, and your like design language and all these other things that you need to consider. So all of these decisions, they kind of compound on each other. And if you don't know who you're designing for, then you can't make these decisions because they're all equally valid.
You mentioned design language. That's something I've always been fascinated by because obviously the big tech companies, Google, like as you mentioned, or Apple, they have their fancy design languages. And is that something that when you work at a particular company or a particular product, is that like one of the things that I guess as a designer you have to define is like, what is the design language for this product or company that I'm working at?
If it hasn't been defined already, then that should be one of the first things you do is define the design language. And so all it is, it's not like it sounds like a fancy word, but all it is like a set of rules, set of paradigms and like design patterns that you can use for your product. And it's sort of, it's a way to keep your decisions consistent. So if you have created a particular design language, like you want to use certain colors because they resonate well with the target audience that you're dealing with, right? Like, or the particular sensibilities of your product, right? Like green is a common color for financial apps, right? And like blue is a common color just in the tech industry in general. So you make these decisions, and so you can keep them consistent throughout your experience. It's not that big of a deal when, in all honesty, it's probably still a big deal when you're one designer working at a tiny company, but it becomes an even bigger deal when you have multiple designers now making decisions around your product and building out individual features, right? You don't want one designer to decide to put an editing function inside of a modal, or you hit this edit button, modal pops up, and a different designer to decide like, oh, we're going to do an inline edit over here. Now, that may be a perfectly valid decision. It may be the right decision to make, in all honesty, but it has to be purposeful, and it can't be just because one person prefers it over the other. And usually you can set that as one of your standards instead of your design language. Like in our case, we are going to decide that all editing will happen inside of a modal because editing doesn't happen that often. You know, it can be a secondary action, and we can then tailor our views for readability rather than editability. Because if you're going to allow for editing, now you need extra space for, you know, form padding and stuff like that. Like there's all these other things that you need to consider into it. And there's, like I said, there's trade-offs to everything. And so if you make that decision early on, that's it'll pay off dividends for you later, because then you don't have to worry about it again. You don't have to keep remaking the same decision. And that's what the design language is there to support.
Got it. And how do you, I guess, other times where two design languages clash, what comes to my mind, and this is something I've seen happen over the course of, iPhones and Android tablets becoming popular, is that I've seen apps try to mimic the design language of the platform. I've also seen apps trying to enforce their own design language. And I think I've also seen apps pick an iPhone design or iOS design language and then force it on Android. And all of those have their pros and cons. But I guess, what is the train of thought there? How do you kind of bring those two worlds together when you as a company have your own design language and then the platform that you're going to be on has its own?
Yeah. It's a bit of a tough one. I'm sure Google would love for everybody to adopt Material Design who puts out like an Android product. But the reality is, like, you're not going to redesign your entire app for Apple and then for Android separately, right? You're going to release them roughly at the same time. They're going to be, you know, based on similar design sensibilities, similar flows. You might tailor the navigation a little bit from like tabs to segmented controls, from going from Android to iOS, but you're not going to like redo the whole thing. The good thing is, though, I think, you know, if you're a sensible designer, you're going to create a language that is, you know, hopefully on trend enough that you can fit into the design languages of the OS that you're dealing with directly. Now, that said, you don't have to necessarily use the paradigms or like the built-in UI from anything. You know, if you're building a native app, or even if you're building like a browser-based app, which is becoming progressively more common, at least from what I've seen on for like web develop or for mobile development, is having, you know, responsive apps rather than having native apps. But you can make it so that it sort of complements one another, because for the most part, the design language from your mobile OS will, it kind of only minorly affects what you're doing. Most of the design language people are going to be interacting with, like most of the UI elements that people are interacting with are going to be whatever you've coded in. Now, maybe you don't want to. Maybe you want to use native components, and that's perfectly fine. In which case, your design language is going to fit anyway, and you're golden.
Now, you mentioned that a sensible designer would, I guess, design things that are on trend. I guess, how do you come up with that? Like, is that a matter of like using the latest, greatest products, see what, you know, other people are doing? How do you just, you know, are there trends that are emerging right now that you're kind of keeping tabs on?
So I try to keep my pulse on the current design trends all the time. I said on trend enough. You don't want to be like, right. So, you know, usually you see trends emerging on Dribbble. If you're not aware, like, it's just, it's like a social media platform for designers, spelled Dribble. So it's three B's. And you can go on there and just see little snippets of work that designers post. Originally, I think it was supposed to be like 200 by 200 pixel images, maximum of whatever's going on. And since then, they've lifted those limits. Similar to like Twitter, they've lifted their character limits and stuff. And so you can go in and see the kind of popular, cool things that people are posting. And usually it's very trendy and not very functional. And so like the big visual trend right now, for example, or at least for like the last little bit, has been neumorphism, which is like, if you remember when Apple first came out with the iPhone, every app, every icon was intended to mirror like a real world counterpart. It was supposed to look realistic, like your phone book app looked like a phone book, or like your, you know, your little black book diary thing or whatever. Well, that was skeuomorphism, and then it got shifted over to the far other end of the spectrum where people are like, no, you don't need to make things literally look like what they look like, because it's really expensive, it's really complicated, and it's very difficult to make a cohesive looking design in skeuomorphism. So they went with a very flat aesthetic. So everything became like icons and iconography. And that's where like material design, really shone, with these kind of like more simplified forms. And now they've sort of, some designers have started coming out with this kind of merged aesthetic where it's still kind of flat looking, but now you're incorporating these shadows to create these textures and differences in or perceived differences in height in your UI. And it looks beautiful, but it takes up so much space. It is absolutely not functional for anybody who is building like something that's not like a landing page or like a login form or something that only has like a couple of inputs and a button. You know, once you're dealing with something really complicated, like, you know, in Routific, we have a lot of panels, a lot of information, a lot of bits of information. Neumorphism wouldn't work at all. But visually it looks great. But there's certain things from that aesthetic that you can borrow, like, you know, for example, like a very clean color palette and using specific contrasting colors to make things pop really well. Or you know, uses of these like gradual lighter shadows that don't like just jump at your eyes being like very cheap looking, but they're a lot more subtle and a lot, you know, a lot cleaner looking. So there's things that from there that you can borrow. But then there's like also other design trends, right? Like VR is the, I mean, it's been like a big thing for the last little bit, but even like, you know, with the metaverse announcement that Mark Zuckerberg did a little while ago, of, you know, kind of, I guess he's trying to mimic Ready Player One, where everybody lives in like, you know, their like VR universe or whatever, which is, I'm not going to lie, it's kind of cool. Like once they come out with a MMO where I can be like a wizard in virtual reality space, man, I'm going to be all there. I think maybe we're a little bit far away from that. But even without that, like Microsoft, I think it was Microsoft, released their really cool bit of product work. It was maybe a year ago now, I guess, where they had like the Microsoft, almost like a Google Lens type thing where you put on the glasses and you can sort of virtually interact with people who are working remotely. So sort of like taking this, you know, COVID enforced remote work environment and bridging it with a sort of physical space where you can like interact with people semi really. And I think there's like a really cool opportunity there. I don't know exactly what it'll look like, right? I don't know. Maybe it'll fizzle out into nothing. Maybe people will hate wearing these like VR headsets or goggles or whatever. But I feel like there's something that is potentially really interesting there that could be done. And I know it's been experimented around with a lot with like Microsoft's table stuff and Google Lens and Oculus Rift and all these like little things that have come out over the years. But they've been like getting steam. And I think that is going to be a space that we're going to potentially be designing in more and more down the line. I mean, even like 3D has been like a big visual trend over the last like year or so, maybe a little bit more than that.
Is that coming back again?
Right. So it's, you have like almost like a 3D environment that you're interacting with in your browser in some of these apps. And they're kind of like experimental apps. But now they're like being touted as this like next trend to like watch for in like 2021 and 2022 and stuff like that. And I remember when I was in university, this must have been like 2008 or something like that. And I took a class where one of the things we were supposed to do was make a toy store app. I don't know if you remember this. You must have seen me working on it. But we decided to make it in Flash and had like a plugin for navigating three-dimensional. We had a plugin from, I think it was Cinema 4D, to render out into like an FLV file that you could then have a whole bunch of frames in that you could navigate between. And we created like a Flash site to move around in a 3D space. And I remember our prof being like, yeah, this is kind of cool, but it's totally impractical, and just like totally making fun of us for it. And now it's just coming right back around.
The thing I find interesting is with 3D, right? Like they were selling like 3D TVs several years back, and you know it was supposed to be that hot new thing, and then it just fizzled out. So as a designer and really you're making decisions that could last for many years, sometimes decades, depending on how often that product might get updated, and also a lot of money investment going, whether it's from the amount of time you're spending, but really the amount of time all the developers build your vision. How do you make sure that you don't fall into the trap of selecting a technology that ends up going to the waste bin?
Yeah. So as a general rule, we don't work on anything that's not proven, right? Like, we let companies like Facebook, especially in the startup world, like you're going to let companies like Facebook take the charge for the most part on a lot of these things. If the core of your product is not to be innovative in a technological sense, not necessarily not to be innovative, because I think Rotific is actually quite like technologically innovative, but innovative in the sense of like coming out with this like crazy new revolutionary technology, right? Like we're innovative in terms of like our algorithms, our user experience, like other aspects of it. But the goal of the company isn't to come out with like the next big way to interact with your software. Kind of like how Oculus Rift wanted to do it, or how like, PlayStation VR does it or something like that. Right. I think that, when it comes to that, that should be your first litmus test for picking a technology is like, is this actually going to work? And is this something that people have actually asked for? I mean, before we started recording the podcast, you were saying that, the Amazon's core principle is to be like the most customer centric company in the world. And that's at the end of the day, like the key is, do people actually want this? Because nobody asked for 3D TVs. Nobody likes to wear glasses. Like, especially if you, like me, you already wear glasses. What do I need another pair of glasses for on top of these things so I can watch TV for like a faux sense of realism? I'm like, I didn't ask for it. I don't care about a slight bit of depth in my, perceived image. Like, it's kind of cool to go watch Avatar in 3D, but nothing has really compared to that in terms of a 3D experience for going to the movies. Where I think the VR stuff is a little bit different is the VR becomes a tool for you to be able to meaningfully interact with something, right? With the space around you. So, for anybody who's living in the Lower Mainland, like there's a few VR arcades that you can go into. And you put on the VR headset and you're moving around in a physical space and interacting with it. And it is insanely cool. You're moving in a one-to-one ratio through this virtual environment.
Actually, our buddy Jonathan, who worked at SolidGrounds, he owns one of those VR places out at Richmond, the Sandbox VR. He owns the franchise there.
He owns that? I've been there a ton of times. I didn't know John owned that.
Yeah, he's a part owner of that, and I think they're starting a couple of more. But that is one of the coolest experiences I've had, where you like put on the suit and you're right there with your buddies, but then you're like killing zombies, and it's such an amazing experience.
The beautiful thing is, like, it's not even a suit; it's just like a set of bracelets and anklets that you put on, and this vest and the headset. And the headset isn't actually like tied into anything. It's and not only that, but the before I went to Sandbox, not to plug John's company, I guess, but before I went to Sandbox, I had to take my glasses off to use VR headsets, and I'd always wind up with a bit of a blurry image because like I don't have 20/20 vision. Like my vision is pretty bad. But this place has little lenses that they put in as corrective lenses into your headset. So they've already started to accommodate the user demographic that is liable to use their headsets. Since you can't use it with glasses, we might as well just put your corrective lenses as inside of it as part of it. And it's really good. It's really cool.
That's a very inclusive thing to do.
Yeah, for sure. And I think like I really appreciated it when I put it on. I was like, oh, this is great. Because I remember like the glasses have been an issue for like ever, right? I went my wife and I, like, well before COVID, we went snorkeling in Mexico to go swim with the sea turtles, and sea turtles are huge and you can see them, but as we're like swimming around, I had to take my glasses off and put the snorkel on, and Leanna, who does have like 20/20 vision, she's, you know, pointing at stuff and's like, oh hey, look, cool, look at that squid that's concealed as part of like the sand or something. She's like, can you see it? And I'm like, no, I can't see anything. Of course I can't. Coming into like the VR space, I was kind of expecting to have, you know, a bit of a blurry experience or whatever, and just to see that and like the change in technology from like the first time I went to a VR arcade to that next time that I went, I was like, oh man, this has progressed a long way, and being able to move around in a physical space was great. So I think like, and not to say that you necessarily is going to be like a giant bulky headset. Like I think they're going to probably get slimmed down, get into something that's more like glasses oriented, maybe similar to Google Glass, but you know, a lot more functional, I guess. I don't remember what the exact issues with Google Glass were that never took off, but that idea of like that augmented reality space and being able to interact with it in a meaningful way, I think is a potential like very real future technological trend that, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, I have no idea what the timelines are, but I can see that being like a real thing to interact with. Now, the question to ask afterwards is, even if this becomes like a real trend, is this still useful for logistics software? And the answer is probably not, right? Like, I mean, maybe, right? Like, depending on what you're doing, maybe there's a potential to interact with a map in like faux, like real space, and like you can clearly zoom in on a particular route and pinpoint specific stops and maybe move them around between routes or something like that, or be able to see like where your driver is in real time and like pull up these reports or something like that. Maybe there is, but it's probably not going to be something that's doable in the near term for sure. And so for now, you know, you make that technological decision like, no, browser-based app, right? Like the lowest point of entry to say, you know, you log in, you have all of this accessible regardless of which computer you use. You don't necessarily need to worry about saving files to your hard drive. It all gets like logged into the cloud. All of this information is readily available, then syncs to your mobile app or whatever else is going on, right? It's easier to sync with your drivers. You know, it opens up an API that maybe people don't want to use a front end. They just want to be able to tap into our algorithm. And, you know, and we have an option for that, for clients to do that instead, and tie into whatever software they're currently using. So there's, it's all driven by client need, right? Like, can we expect like, you know, a mom and pop shop, you know, 60-year-old lady who runs, I don't know, a flower shop and needs deliveries once in a while? Can we really expect her to log in to a VR headset and invest, you know, probably like $4,000 into the actual technology to be able to use the VR headset properly and then interact with our software? That's a bit of an unreasonable thing to ask. So it's always dictated by the client. It's always dictated by the user. Every decision that you make, I think.
Now, when you have this vision defined and you've got designs, what is your development process like? Because I think one of the things that I've seen be disconnected in software delivery, because at the end of the day, you got to turn that vision or those drawings into a real world working software. And, you know, we have the software development life cycles. And I know the security side, you know, they've been trying to push secure software development life cycle where it includes security in it. On the design side, are there things that as an industry you guys are trying to do to improve how developers and designers interact with each other?
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of them. I'll be honest with you. I'm not strongly opinionated on which type of process or lifecycle to use. And to be honest with you, like, I think it's dependent on like whatever works for the team, whatever works for the company. And it'll be different, I think, at different stages of the software lifecycle. So, you know, I've used Scrum, Kanban, ShapeUp, and Waterfall. And probably a few other ones through my time. But like what I found is they're different for different purposes. So for example, something like ShapeUp, where you are building the design essentially at the same time as the developers are developing it. You kind of, you know, you go through this de-risking process and then like the shaping process and stuff like that afterwards. Well, that's great. And it's fantastic if your software has been launched and released and you're iterating on specific elements of it. And you're, you know, part of the philosophy in ShapeUp is you're making pitches and then you're deciding like, okay, we're going to bet 6 weeks on this particular pitch and see if it works out. And so you have that 6 week, you know, time limit to do whatever it is that you're planning to do. I think that's pretty fantastic. Where it doesn't work so well is in a process like, you know, Rotific right now is going through a rewrite of their main software. And in that case, where we're now kind of futzing around with the design language and trying to figure out like the new design patterns from everything that we've learned from the previous iteration of our software, it's not live. Like we have our previous version live and being used and worked on, but the new one isn't. And so as a consequence, the lead time required on a lot of the design work is actually longer. And if we don't have that lead time, we become the bottleneck for the development process. So you can't use something that works exactly in lockstep like that. You know, you don't necessarily want to go fall back to like a full, you don't want to go to a full waterfall process for sure. But maybe something more akin to Kanban works a little bit better where you're shifting particular projects through individual stages. So it just depends. And I don't have a strong opinion one way or the other. It just depends on the particular situation that any company will find themselves in. You know, 2 years from now, when our, you know, V3 product has been live for a long time and we're just mostly iterating on particular features inside of that, Kanban may not work very well at all. It may be entirely too slow and we may want to move to something like Scrum or whatever else, right? Like, who knows? But that has to be like a purposeful decision that gets made. And the design requirements will change from one to the other. So early on in the process, especially early on, you want to invest into those design tools and that takes time. So developing your design language, coming up with like all of these decisions or as many of these decisions as you can up front, you know, whether it's like things like grids and font sizes and, you know, what kind of padding do you want to use? What kind of patterns do you want to use for editing? What kind of patterns do you want to use for displaying stuff? What kind of color choices do you want to make? Front loading those decisions requires a lot of effort and time as you're also working on product stuff. And so just accommodating for that in the process, I think, is probably the biggest thing. And then the other thing that's been a big issue, thankfully, it hasn't really been a massive problem in the companies that I've had an opportunity to work at, is not having design at the table to make a lot of these decisions, right? Like, I'm sure there's still a ton of companies that are making top-down product decisions and kind of handing these edicts down from on high without really considering what are the design implications of this. Like, I've had these conversations with a few people in my time. It's like, well, why is this design taking so long, right? All you're doing is like just moving some stuff around on like an artboard or a screen or whatever. And it kind of speaks to this lack of understanding of the amount of decision making that goes into any particular bit of design. Thankfully, I haven't had too many of those experiences, but they are there. And I'm sure they're a lot more common in maybe some of these older minded companies and stuff like that. So I think that that's the other thing is like, being at the table, not necessarily from like an ego-driven thing of like, oh, I want to seat at the big boys table and make decisions or whatever. More from the perspective of like, if you're not there, you can't help people understand why certain things take time, right? Like if somebody came up to a particular developer and was like, oh yeah, you know, just code this thing for me, right? Like just do this thing. You know, it shouldn't take you very long, but they don't have any understanding of the development processes. You know, they may be thinking like, oh yeah, you're just changing, you know, this bit of code. But in reality, if they're not familiar with the code base, maybe you're touching a whole bunch of files as a consequence. And then you have to do some regression testing. And then you have to, you know, you have to probably potentially have to come up with your own test plans. And you have to, you know, then QA some of your work, depending on like if you're also in charge of doing QA stuff, you know, depending on the size of your company. So there's all of these hidden costs. And it's true for, I think, any discipline, right? Like you may ask marketing people, hey, just do this ad for me. But there's a lot of decisions. There's a lot of thought and care that needs to go into an ad for to make it successful. And so if you're not at the table of decision makers, not only are you unable to influence those decisions, but you're also unable to advocate for your particular vocation and your particular profession to say that, hey, you know, this is why it takes time. Like you can't educate people to tell them, because it's, you know, people aren't coming at this from a position of malice, right? They're not trying to be like, oh, lazy designers, you should be able to do this quickly. They just don't know. Like it's not a malicious thing. They're not trying to be jerks or anything like that. You know, they're trying to do the best thing for the company, just like everybody else. And until, you know, you have an opportunity to talk to them and teach them and give them an understanding of like, hey, this is what it is that design does. These are the things that need to go into it. This is why it takes a while to come up with good design. And this is why we need the research and whatever other resources that we need. Then, you know, you're constantly going to be having that disconnect.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the things that I've experienced at some companies, and I think, you know, from talking to folks, it happens at a lot of companies, is this conversation about people feeling like they don't have a seat at the table. And obviously being on the development side, I've certainly heard a lot of developers feel like they don't have a seat at the table. So it's very interesting to see that, you know, designers are feeling the same thing. So it does lead to, I think, probably, I guess, uncovering something that's happening, you know, in our industry, where we're not all coming together from all facets of the, you know, that are involved, right? Like product management, you got, you know, you got designers, you got developers. Quite frankly, you got our support, like folks that are dealing with customers day to day, right? If they're not all involved in this process, then, you know, even like you said, it's not out of malice, but they're leaving things behind, and then the customer ends up suffering at the end of the day. How do you go about trying to make sure that like everybody's got a say? And, you know, for example, in the design process, where, you know, I've heard developers complain where they're like, well, the design came up with some fancy thing, it looks awesome, but we can't get this done, right? Or we'll get it done in 2 years if you want it. So how do you make sure that disconnect doesn't happen?
I mean, this may sound like a really stupid thing to say, but you just talk to people. you're like, I think that where you see that kind of breakdown, I think it usually stems from maybe inexperienced or general like lack of leadership for whatever reason, right? Lack of experience or maybe lack of awareness or maybe just weak leadership in general. I think that's where you usually see that kind of thing stem from, because the biggest thing that you can do, like now we're shifting away from like the specific design role and now to my like leadership role, is that the biggest thing you can do is build really good rapport and relationships across your peer group in a company. And so this is important at all levels. It's not just true necessarily in leadership. You know, when I was a designer, I had one-on-ones with developers and our PMs and stuff like that. And now that I'm, you know, in a director role, I have one-on-ones with, you know, the director of marketing and the director of product and all of these other kind of critical people, and like our development managers, people who are in leadership roles in these other parts of the organization. And it's not just for funsies, although I like all the people that I work with and I just kind of hang out with them anyway. But a big part of it is just to expose some of these conversations, right? When developers aren't feeling like they're heard, or they're not feeling that they have the ability to influence the design earlier on, you know, how does that come back to me? I generally don't get an opportunity to interact with developers one-on-one too often. But I do talk to the dev managers who do talk to the developers. And so it has to come back to me through them to say like, hey, you know, we're our developers are feeling like they're getting blindsided by some of these designs. And I'm like, okay, let's fix it. And then we come to a decision right there and then to say like, hey, here's what we're going to do to address this. Let's, you know, in our case, we were having some issues around not exactly developers not having quite enough input, but not enough input early on. And so we're like, okay, well, how do we do this? And so at Rotific, the design team, we have an end of day sync a few times a week where we just showcase whatever, you know, work in progress stuff we have. And it was an internal design thing because you feel safe talking to other designers about your incomplete work because they understand. And so, you know, it's safe for designers to beat up your incomplete work, but showing it to developers, you know, it can be an intimidating process. But what we've done is we've just opened it up to at least the you know, some of the development team, like a few key members, to be able to start coming in, a few key representatives from each of our individual dev teams, to come in and be like, hey, even if you're just a fly on the wall, or if you want to participate and provide your input on like this design work and stuff like that. And it's worked out really fantastically. You know, it's allowed, you know, another source of input, another voice earlier on in the process. And that happened because people have good enough relationships to be able to talk to each other. But it always comes back to that relationship piece. Like, you need those good relationships across your entire company and build rapport with people. So A, they feel comfortable talking to you, and B, when they feel comfortable talking to you, they feel comfortable being open with you. So it's not, so they're not trying to like sugarcoat their feedback or feel like, oh, maybe I'm stepping on somebody's toes, or maybe I shouldn't say this. I don't want to be seen as like whatever. And they can just openly say like, hey, here's what's going on. And because you've built that relationship, there's that mutual trust to say like, yeah, this is going to be received in a positive way because it's just, it's feedback. We're both on the same side. We're both trying to figure out what is best for this company. How do we best, you know, make sure that design and development are working together, so we're getting the best quality design, we're getting the best quality dev work. You know, it, at the end of the day, you're a team. And if there's not that alignment on the leadership level, I think that's where you're going to start seeing the breakdown further down the line. And it has to be alignment all through the leadership ranks. You know, in a company like Rotific, we have like 30 people. So it's a pretty flat work structure. In a company like Amazon, you probably have a few more layers to that there. But that's kind of how I see it. Relationships, that's sort of the be-all and end-all in terms of leadership currency.
That's so critical though, right? It's something I've been, even with my developers, I always tell them like, oh, get out of the team, go have one-on-ones with our legal team, right? Go have one-on-ones with our product managers, because ultimately it's those relationships that you're building. And also you're going to learn a lot, right? Like just syncing up with your product manager and just understanding how they think about a problem allows you to understand them or embody them even in some ways the next time you have to encounter a new problem. Are there things that you think product or development managers could do better to engage with the design teams?
Honestly, I think, look, you know, I think engagement is a two-way street. And I think that oftentimes I've seen designers also be not necessarily unwilling to engage, but they may not understand the virtue of, you know, meeting people outside of their specific vocation, and talking to these other people in these other teams who have roles that maybe don't necessarily directly impact you. So I think it's a two-way street. I think, you know, people need to open up dialogue on both sides. But at the end of the day, like, honestly, it's just about that layer of communication and building out those relationships. You know, like, just kind of tying it all in together, you know, I mentioned part of the reason why you want to be involved in the, you know, decision-making, why you want a seat at the table, so to speak, is to be able to educate other people around what you do. Well, there's a lot of ways to do that. And so at Routific, one of the things, you know, like many other startup companies, we've got like a Friday all hands meeting. And in that, it's taken a few forms, but more recently we started having individual departments do kind of like 20-ish minute presentations, state of the union type address to the rest of the company. Like, hey, here's what's going on in development. Here's what's going on with customer success. Here's what's going on with marketing. Here's what's going on with sales. Here's what's going on with design. And so design did theirs, I think 2-3 weeks ago now, kind of as the cycle goes through. And what I like to do in these things, I like to open it up to everybody on the team to be able to participate and kind of showcase their work, mostly so they can practice presentation skills, which is really important because you want to be able to pitch your work well to other people. And that's a skill that often gets missed in design. I don't know if you have designers listening to this podcast or not, but that's the big thing that gets missed. It's probably a big thing that gets missed on the development side of things as well. So one of the things I like to do apart from that is, I like to pick out sort of a meteor topic and do a bit of a narrative dive into it. And so one of the things we've been doing right now is a visual redesign of our current like in alpha product. And so I was like, okay, we've gone through this. And I went through the steps of like, okay, why do we want to do this? You know, what's the point? Like, why do we even want to try to tackle a visual redesign? Why is this worth it? And I did a dissection, you know, like a very quick heuristic analysis of our UI, and I pointed out all of these faults in it. And I was like, okay, here's all the inconsistencies, and then, you know, here's what we want to address. And then the inevitable question is like, well, how are we going to address it? And it's like, well, we're creating a design language, and we have to cover all of these things. And I created like this laundry list of items that we wanted to cover, you know, font sizes and spacings and grids and patterns and all of these things. And, you know, it took me about a minute and a half to go through the slide and like very like rapid fire express all the things that all these decisions that we want to make, all these things that are like bugging me and bugging all the other designers and stuff like that. And it was funny. I had a number of people reach out to me with a similar comment, but I had one of our dev manager reach out to me as well. And she was saying like, yeah, I didn't know half the stuff that you guys were doing. She's like, I wasn't aware of like all of these things that go, she's like, I kind of know what design does, but like, I had no idea that all of these decisions like needed to get made and all of these, things had to get accounted for. She's like, and to be honest, I didn't even see half the things that you mentioned in your presentation of the app. And now that you've told me about them, I can't unsee them. Now they bug me too. And I'm like, yeah, this is the point. Like, this is how you open up that dialogue. And like, people, if you open up yourself, people will reach out to you. And in this case, like, I already have a one-on-one with Carol, and you know, we've been building out a pretty good relationship. But it's one of those things where like, if you open up to people, they'll come and talk to you, and they'll be willing to reach out to you directly. So, you know, I hesitate to put the burden on the dev managers to be like, oh, you have to do such and such. It's a pretty good practice for everybody, regardless of what role you're in, to reach out to your peers, you know, the people who are the other people who are responsible for various aspects of your organization, whether it's legal, whether it's customer success, whether it's HR. HR is a super important one that I think everybody should go talk to. Make good relationships with your HR people, especially if you're in leadership, because they are fantastic folk that do a lot of support for you. You know, building out those relationships is a good idea for everybody. And it's certainly a good idea for the designers to be able to reach out and say, hey, how's it going? Let's go grab a coffee, or let's get a virtual coffee, you know, if you're working remotely or whatever the case is. And just you know, don't make everything about work. Take the time, you know, to ease into conversations and have a chat. Like, you know, it could be something as innocuous as like what you did this weekend, or maybe it was a podcast that you listened to, or a movie that you watched, or an article that you read. Just something interesting to dive into and have a conversation with, just like as people. You know, treat people like people, and they'll treat you pretty well. And eventually you'll find out that, hey, you've become pretty good friends, and you can be really comfortable talking to each other about whatever issues are going on at work. Because a lot of times, issues will resolve very quickly if you confront them directly in a kind of safe and understanding and caring environment. And they only become really problematic when they are allowed to fester for too long. I don't know. That's just me on my soapbox, though.
That was wonderful. So on that note, if someone wanted to get a hold of you to either get more information about the company you're at, or even just questions about design, what's the best way for them to reach out to you? Are you on social media or anything similar?
Oh man, I'm so bad at social media. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and stuff like that, but I never check those things. Like, I don't think I've been on Facebook in like 4 months or something like that. I probably have a ton of messages that I'll be honest with you, it's made my life better. And the only thing I really use Instagram for is to like follow a bunch of like fitness influencers to make myself feel a bit more motivated to go work out. So if people want to get a hold of me, the best thing to do is probably LinkedIn, which I check reasonably frequently, and I get like push notifications to my phone anyway. So I'm Michael Yablonsky on LinkedIn. There's not that many of us, and there's certainly only one of us that works at Routific. And then if anybody wants to get a hold of me directly, michael@routific.com is my email, and you can feel free to message me as well.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. And thanks for joining the podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks, everybody.